Hi, this is Sarah. If you like this episode of Let's Talk About Sects, you can listen to my audiobook, Do As I Say, How Cults Control, Why We Join Them, and What They Teach Us About Bullying, Abuse and Coercion. The audiobook will be available on Audible, Apple Books, Google and Kobo from the 28th of June. A link is in the show notes.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Grace Adams and Poya Alpha are two sisters from New Zealand who joined David Koresh's Branch Davidians in the 1980s, along with their younger sister Rebecca. Poya left the sect in early 1990 and Grace in late 1991. Rebecca remained with the group at the compound in Waco, Texas, and perished in the fire of April 1993. Grace and Poya have recently released their memoir called Hearken, O Daughter, and I caught up with them on a recent trip to Auckland. Welcome to Let's Talk About Sects, a podcast about cults around the world. I'm your host, Sarah Steele. This month's episode is a little different to usual, as last month's two-part episode left me with less spare time than usual to work on researching the next sect. So instead I'm bringing you a fascinating conversation that I had with two former Branch Davidians on a recent trip to Auckland, New Zealand. Grace and Poya are setting up a support group for cult survivors in New Zealand, and just this year self-published their book Hearken, O Daughter. I'll provide the links to where you can find a copy in the show notes. Grace and Poya shared with me their process in co-writing their book, their memories of their sister Rebecca, their impressions of David Koresh and how they came to be under his spell and joined the Branch Davidians, what got them out of the cult while their sister remained, and their journey to recovery. They were both so generous with their time and have hopes that sharing their experiences will help others in similar situations, as well as help those outside to understand how these kinds of high-demand groups often seem to operate. Before we continue, a content warning. This episode will deal with issues that some people may find disturbing related to controlling behaviours, emotional and physical abuse, including of children, suicide and murder. Please use your discretion as to whether this will be suitable for you and those around you who may be listening too. Just quickly, if you haven't listened to episode 8 of season 1 about the Branch Davidians, it may be worth having a listen to that one first to give you a bit of background to Grace and Poya's story. If you skipped that one because you already know a fair bit about the group, a couple of things that are referred to in our conversation relate to when Grace was confined by David Koresh for 4 months between June and September of 1991, after she began hearing a voice in her head that instructed her to do and say strange and sometimes dangerous things. Instead of sending her to hospital, Koresh had her locked up in a cabin, under guard, for 4 months. Grace believes that her mental condition was directly related to her experiences, and in Hearken, O Daughter, she says, quote, There were a lot of horrible things that happened to me during my confinement, which are too graphic for me to mention. These and what I tell in my story are what caused me to behave in a psychotic way. To end her confinement, Grace sent a message to Koresh that her visa had expired, knowing that the last thing he wanted was the authorities sniffing around the compound. The day he received her message, Koresh said that God had given him permission for her to be allowed to leave. After this, Grace spent some time in Mills Peninsula Hospital in San Francisco. Grace was previously known as Doreen, but changed her name during her recovery process in the aftermath of leaving the sect. She says to, quote, re-establish who I was and celebrate who I had become. We spoke for almost 2 hours, and I found both Grace and Poya to be absolutely lovely people. It was hard to imagine the horrible personality Grace says she took on whilst in the Branch Davidians. The two have obviously been through a lot, and there's plenty to be learned from them. So without further ado, please find following the edited highlights of our chat.
Do you know what hearken means?
Hear.
Hear.
It's to listen and to pay attention, to behold even. It's an old English word for those, you know, hearken, listen.
Because we used King James. Mm.
Uh-huh.
So that this term was used a lot and used to justify why he could take any woman, as his wife, because of this.
It's found in Psalm 45, but he's taken it out of context, as they do.
The first question I had was, how did you come upon the decision to write the book?
I'll let Grace answer that, because she was the one that had always wanted to write the book shortly after the compound went.
Yeah, so I came out in 91, and that event happened in 93. I came out, I was really angry. And, there was a lot of stuff that I needed to process, so I tried to verbally tell people this is what was going on, this was what was done to me. And it was just frustrating because my brain just wasn't syncing with my mouth, and everything just sounded, you know, like a lot of nonsense. And so eventually I just started journaling, and then as I journaled, you know, all the stuff was coming out, and then I realised I think I would like to write a book. And that was in the 90s, you know, in the early 90s, before, you know, 93 event happened. And then that came and went, and I was still thinking, all right, but it never did happen because I didn't have time. I didn't sort of know where to start until I came to New Zealand, you know, because I was living in the States. I ran some cult awareness classes at our church, and Poya came to the first one. She didn't say anything, but it wasn't till this year that we did the thing again that we decided, hey, you know, we can write our story. Yeah, we have something to help other people.
So yeah, I was wondering about the process of writing the book. A couple of things, you know, you alternated the chapters. So how did you come up with a subject for each part, and then kind of both? What was the process?
Well, the process was, as I said, I already had something there, so I had pre-put headings, and even right down to what I was going to call the book. And it wasn't Hearken, O Daughter. It was something else. It was called The Message. You know, because that's So I had the headings, and I decided, oh, let's do it on Google Docs, and then that just got a bit frustrating. And I think I delete some of Poya's things in the process, and some of my things. So, and I thought no, and so we decided, why not just type our stories separately? So that's what happened, and it was great. And then when we saw it, you know, come together as one book, thought, oh yeah, that's what we want. Yeah.
Yeah, and it really, it worked really well, kind of seeing it from
back
the
and
two
forth.
Different perspectives and kind of swapping between them. It was really interesting to read it that way too.
So. Oh, good.
Yeah. We wanted to get our story across with our voice, Yeah, that's what we really wanted, was that we had been through the experience, not the publisher or the ghostwriter or anybody else. So that's why we wanted to retain the authenticity of our story through our own voices.
Yeah, that's why we didn't go for a regular publisher.
How long did it actually take to write all up?
I would say about a year and a half. We had probably written the most within 7 months.
So about this time last year.
There were places where we didn't want to go and revisit again because of the emotions that it would bring up. So we did a lot of crying together, laughing about the ridiculous things that, you know, was happening in them, that we were accepting, some of the things that just, there was stuff that we just couldn't verbalize and put into words. So we had to just get it all out and talk about it first before we could write about it. And once we started excavating those areas, we felt less
burdened.
What would you say? Less burdened, and we felt we could freely write it without getting too much detail in the book. We felt it was part of writing the process was to unload and download and be healed and get the stuff out of our system, because we knew there were things there that we had not really, we had kept to ourselves, but we needed to get out. And we were, being together was the best way that we could get it out, because we knew what we were talking about. No one else did. The only reason why we got it done it quickly within 7 months was because we put a deadline. We placed it in, like, we've got to get it ready before April 19th.
Anniversary, the 25th anniversary, which was this year.
Yes.
So, how about we get it out before the anniversary?
Yes. We wanted the book ready before we were going to visit the Waco, Texas. So that's what really got us into gear. However, you know, our venues weren't quite the best venues to write a book. And because we have a busy household, we couldn't do it at home. So we did it in
McDonald's, library, our brother's house when he was away.
when we were house-sitting. And the church.
It just goes to show you actually can write a book, you know, on the run, so to speak.
And we were both working full-time, 9 to 5.
Yeah, you know, so everything was about the book.
But we didn't get it finished in April 19.
You know, now we see it was a good thing, because in there are the photos from the memorial, and so it's current, you know. But I had been, and I mentioned in the book, to Waco a few times before, mostly on my own. And then some of it was with the, you know, telling my story to different media. But that was the first time Poya had been back. So it was
since
1990. She left in 1990. So wow. That was a long time after.
How did that feel for you?
I felt okay. I felt I had moved on. I felt excited that I was going to see what it was like now. I knew it would be different. And it made me stand there and have a sense of, okay, this is where it ends. It was closure for me, you know. And I also felt, you know, just wondering what would have gone through Rebecca's mind as I stood there looking
at sister.
Our sister. And how now there's a chapel there that's been built over the ground where the compound had been. How she would have felt in those last moments of her life. So it was closure, and I was really thankful that I was able to have that opportunity to just go and leave everything that was connected with the group right there.
So I wondered if you feel like it, don't feel obliged, but if you'd like to share a bit with me about who she was and what kind of a person she was.
I know her better than Grace did, because this was before Grace came back from her overseas trip. I was with Rebecca most of the time, and we did get quite close.
So this was the age differences then?
So there's 8 years between Rebecca and I.
Yeah.
And so there'd be 10 years with you and Rebecca.
So it's about just under 10 years, yes. She was just such a fun, loving young woman, yes. And she was just so adventurous and sometimes daring, you know, in her spirit of adventure. But, yeah, she was somebody that I would love, loved being with and enjoyed, and she would watch me as a mother because I had two young boys then, and she loved spending time with her two nephews who were about 3 and 5 at the time. She looked up to me a lot. I feel that she saw me as a mentor. She was very, very close, and so that was her nature, was to learn as much as she could watching me as a mother, as a leader, and as a Christian. She took on the same faith as I did, knowing that the Lord Jesus is her Saviour, and that, you know, God is the ultimate one that she needs to give her allegiance to, and also provide her purpose and plan in her life. So that was basically her ideology, I would say, was just to follow her Saviour. It's a paradox in the sense that this is what actually got her, drew her into the group, the same way it drew me, the same way it drew Leslie, the same way it drew Grace.
I didn't fully see that beauty which Poi had seen in her prior to, you know, joining the Davidians. But she was a lovely, you know, loved life. You know, she probably would have had her own travel agency by now because, you know, she liked to travel as well, like me.
She was also her surrogate mum as she was growing up.
So yeah, that's and, you know, in the Samoan culture, we help with, you know, our siblings because our mum was working, our dad was working. So I kind of raised her, you know, so I was, there, and she was, you know, took care of her. And then, you know, as I got older, I left and did my travelling, and so she pretty much had her teenage years, tweens and teenage years with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and thank you for asking that question, because we don't often talk about her when people interview us, and I think it's nice to sort of give her that honour and sharing who she really was before she became the cult personality.
How much did you feel that he really believed in what he was teaching, and how much do you feel was a manipulation of someone who was just kind of feeding off of the power of having these people under him? Did you have any impression of that at all?
Both of what you, the former and the latter of what you shared, both applied. I believe he was genuine in his early days of you know, wanting to you know, do what was right and fulfill his purpose in life. And as time went on, and we can say that because we were there in 1986, then we went back in 1990, 4 years difference. We noticed the difference, yes. So he was not the quiet, mild Bible study prophet that he was in 1986 when we went to Waco in 1990. He was not the same person. So there was that transition time that we weren't there, we could compare, whereas those that were there like a frog in a hot water, it doesn't know that it's getting hotter and hotter. The people were there, and they were, I believe that it empowered him to see that the people were starting to give over their sense of reason, everything pretty much, their judgment as time went on.
That manipulation came out. Like, I couldn't believe he was showing Jim Jones movies while I was there. I didn't go see it, but Rebecca told me that, you know, she was in his room and they were watching, you know, the Jim Jones, and he would say to them, "Oh, we're not a cult, you know, there's just no way we're not a cult." while he was showing them the Jim Jones tragedy.
He was showing movies of war. What is it called? Something Ryan.
Saving
those kind of movies. Like he war, was, yeah. Yeah, all the war things. You know, when we go to war, we have no fear. So this was his, what he built up his message to be, is that we had to be trained soldiers in God's army. Yeah, then the 93 happened. Prophecy fulfilled. Didn't I tell you? The government will come in and they will, yeah. So it was basically, yeah, everything that happened in 1993 was, and that's why people still believe in him. Current members are still.
He told them
you know, that the government will come in and we need to be ready, get ready for war.
Yeah, so I think initially the intention was good, but I guess power corrupts, you know, and you could see how people were just giving over their...
Stroking the ego.
Their properties there, and so in came the mind control, the manipulation, that narcissism.
And this is what we need to educate people on, is what to look out for with individuals that are... made that, you know, that have those potentials to, you know, become a monster. And I think it's important that, you know, what we went to in the weekend is just amazing how it can be really anybody. You know, the fact is it can be, we have the potential, everyone has the potential not only to be vulnerable but to become the bully.
Yeah, given the right...
Circumstances.
So, you know, you have broken up in your relationship, vulnerable, your marriage,
you've been abused,
dies, you've been abused, nowhere to live, you're away from home, strange town, these nice smiley people come, they talk to you and they do favours for you, and then all of a sudden, you know, your defences that you would normally have in place are gone. You know, you're like, well, these people are nice people, so I don't need to be suspicious of them and their intentions.
And I think that's a really good point that a lot of people miss as well, is that almost every time all of these groups are full of really wonderful people and who are genuinely wonderful.
No one joins a cult. Nobody.
On purpose.
Yeah. They join what they see, what they hear, they're good things. And then all of a sudden, before they know it, you know, their boundaries and everything that they valued, you know, they've been stripped away gradually.
And they see all these people who they care about and respect continue to maybe exhibit behaviours that they would usually disagree with.
Yes,
and
then, they're accepting of it.
It's cognitive dissonance, they call it, where you see what's wrong. Inside you, the real you, you can see it. But because you've been conditioned now through the manipulation, sleep deprivation, control of your diet, time, even down to the very personal things like how much toilet paper are you allowed to use, that kind of thing, you know, and you're living in the environment and you see everybody's conforming. You're the only one that's thinking different? No, I must be, I've got to join them. You know, that's that group dynamics as well. And another thing is that you've got your own family in there and they're doing exactly what you feel that, oh, it's wrong. But, you know, maybe I should stay in for my daughter, my son, my sister, my brother. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you have a narcissistic, predator, he knows all the ways and how to, you know, deceive, manipulate and exploit. And then when he's got you, it's just any time now, it's just he will take you down if he sees that he's going to be taken down. And that's what Koresh did. As soon as he knew he was in the corner, he wasn't going to let any one of those people out, because he knew what was going to happen to him. They're going to suffer the same fate as him. And rather than let them out, he was going to keep them out.
They were trained to the point where, you know, like the Jim Jones thing, you don't go out unless I tell you you go out. Mm. You know, so they were trained to that point where until Prophet says go, we don't go.
Mm.
However, there were the few that did come out. Fortunately, you know, they had sent, you know, they were clear enough to know it's burning, I need to leave.
Mm.
Here was the mothers of those children and the other adults that stayed and children, they knew, well, David didn't say go, so why, you know, why am I going? I need to stay.
Mm. Mm.
He had let some people out before that, though,
right? He did, yeah. He let out some of the children of some of the members that had died, and also
his own children.
Yeah, mm. And some elderly women.
Yeah. Mm. He's very erratic in his decisions too. Like, that was done because of some negotiation with the FBI, and so I guess they were trying to.
He was going to. That was a deal.
There was a deal made, and so unless he did that, he wasn't going to do anything to let anybody out.
Oh, they were just bargaining.
Yeah, and then he pushed the boundaries again. He said after he had the airtime. He didn't do what they were
God
asking.
Said
so,
it wasn't
well, God
time.
Said it's not the time. So that's a psychopath, you know. He just makes his own rules up as he goes.
I think I read somewhere there was a theory that he also only let out the people who wouldn't be as strong in the war.
Yeah, who didn't serve his purposes for that time. So the old people and then some of the children from other families and parents. He would, but his own children, most of them, or. Pretty much all of them stayed
all
in
of them.
Do you think that there is anything that family or friends can do or say? Like, what's the best thing for them to do if they have a family member who is in a group that's similar to this one?
I think education. You know, just like ourselves, we had to educate ourselves and understand what was done to us, and then we realised the enormity of what was done to us, and so too, and this is why we do the cult awareness, is look out for these things, you know. These are the types of things that these leaders do, knowing how to approach the loved one that's still in a group, you know, what to do, what not to do. You know, don't say you're in a cult, you know, even though you know they're in a cult. There are other ways, you know, continue to stay in touch with them, because when or if they ever do have a situation that happens in there, hopefully they'll know to reach out to the family or friends, whereas if you've cut that off, they may not. You know, they may feel, I have nowhere to go, so I may as well stay here.
I also mention in the book that when Rebecca and Grace had shunned, cut me off, I still kept writing letters. I kept writing letters just to give
annoying.
Them memories. well, I thought,
I don't.
She
put smiley faces on the letters, and oh, that's annoying.
Yeah, it just kind of, with the state of mind that they're in, it's just like, get out of here, you know. And, you know, but it didn't bother me. I just said I was just going to do everything that I could and say anything that I could, apart from challenging their, you know, their beliefs, because I knew what they believed in. I just wanted them connected with family, with memories, with love, because they were conditioned. You know, you no longer have a family. I am the family. I am your, yeah, your everything. It's really difficult. It's really, I don't know, 95%, you only have 5% really of likelihood that you will, you know, touch on some chord in their heart. You almost have to sort of stab in the dark to see what will get you out. Yeah. Yeah. In some cases, what he does to you will get you out, because you think, oh, that's enough, you know. Yeah, yeah. Enough is enough. Yeah. Yeah. And it may not be with confinement. It may be with just watching your kids being beaten and beaten and beaten, and then you say, oh, that's enough, I'm going to take my kids now and go. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of thing.
Or the
it's
marriage.
Or the marriage situation where I decided I'd stay, and then Leslie knew exactly what to say, because I was a mother at heart. And when he said what he said, it was, yes, okay, I'm going. You know, all I could see were my two children in my mind, and that drew me. It's the heart that
you have to appeal to
their
heart,
yeah.
The real person.
To the real you, who, you know, the identity that's been stripped from you. Mm. Yeah, it's still there in here, but in the background. Yeah, so you almost have to coax, find some way of getting the real you and connecting with that.
I was not nice. You know, my cult personality was not nice to my family, to my parents, to my siblings that weren't part of, I wasn't nice. Yeah, probably Rebecca was nicer than me, but I was not nice. And they were still you know, though I knew they were hurt, and this is mainly my parents I'm speaking to, they continued to love me, continued to treat me as if, you know,
you were
I'm the daughter that they knew, you know, and that's all they knew, and that was it. And you know, I think with that love, with that unconditional love, it starts, that iceberg starts to melt in places. Mm. Yeah. And I think that's what was going on eventually as I came out. You know, I had nothing and I, you know, just a mess. They continued to love me where I was at.
Mm. Mm. With who you were before.
Yeah. So they didn't treat me like this horrible person, you know.
Yeah. And that's where it's hard for, tough for families.
It's very hard.
Because,
yeah.
you know, they're, oh, what's going wrong with her? You know, yeah. oh, and, you know, and they could retaliate and they don't want her around. But, you know, the hard part is to love somebody. It's
continue.
Just, if you think of it as a child, you don't like their behavior, but you still love them because they're your child. They've come through some trauma, extreme trauma, and they're working their way back into society, into family again.
You both mentioned animals as helpful to
your it's great.
Recovery. Yeah,
same thing. Unconditional, you know. You can,
they're not judging you. They're sitting there and they're listening.
Just listening.
Yeah, they're just there. Yeah. They're just present.
And it's almost like, I feel your pain.
and also the fact that you're, we look after them, you know, we're feeding
responsibility,
them.
You know, you get back
it takes you outside of who,
learning responsibility,
what you're going through.
You get out of your head and care for something else.
I think that's where it starts to stop you from, oh, poor
always
me.
Always looking inward and thinking, but, oh, hard done by.
Depression.
But I did have a pity party. I needed it. But when I got bored with it,
you can only go for so long.
What else can I do?
Boring.
Yeah, so it helped having the two animals to look after and just, you know, goals started, because I'm a very goal-oriented person. You know, before I left, I was a very goal-oriented person, and that kind of gone out the window because that was my goal. You know, all the goals that I had became this big, you know, be part of the group. And then when I came out, I just wasn't sure where to go anymore.
Yeah, animals are amazing, eh? They were so therapeutic.
So
all these little things really help, you know, the music, the instruments. Yeah.
And then a change in career, you know, that was a good thing, because before Waco came, I was just tempting because I needed to be available to leave just like that if we were told. So that's why I never held a permanent job. And so that eventually came into the picture, you know, change of career, and that was good.
When I was playing the guitar and you were unwell?
Oh, that was really good. See, our family's quite musical, and we've grown up with dancing and music and singing, so Poya was just pulled out a guitar. This was during the time I was still, you know.
You'd just come back from
and she would just play, and this was just kind of like calmed.
Soothing.
It was very calming, soothing. So definitely music has some sort of something there too, you know, helps.
Yeah, you credited that hospital with really helping.
Oh, they were amazing. They were absolutely amazing. They obviously didn't know what was going on with me and why I ended up the way I did, but, you know, they were great, really patient. You know, I mean, I do remember a lot of the group sessions, and, you know, they were simple groups at the OT, and if I decided I didn't want to sit there, they were fine. They weren't going to hold me to it. You know, there were times that I did walk out, I'm bored here, you know, so I'd go do something else, and then I might come back. So, you know, there was
freedom
were
to go in and out, which was different to the cold.
And that's what I needed. That's why, and they didn't know that. You know, I needed that ability to walk out and not
make
get
choices.
Castigated for it.
Poira and I were just speaking before, I think, when you took the call about how sometimes people, when they come out of a cult, are treated as if they are experiencing mental illness, when in fact it's actually some trauma.
It's a result of what you went through in the cult. Mm, yeah,
because it definitely it sounded like some sort of psychosis or schizophrenia, even that you had this voice that was speaking to you.
Yes, that's just your brain coping, trying to cope with what
was a coping mechanism
going on with you or being done to you. So I really felt, and this is really strange because I really felt I was observing and I let it happen. You know, I kind of came to the back and I sort of, okay, you lead. You know, I let voice come forward while I observed. And it was kind of funny because, and it felt safe in that background. Mm-hmm. I felt really safe. You know, I thought, well, here I am, you know, someone else is taking control of me and this is good, you know, they can't hurt me back here. Mm. So it really felt safe back there.
Mm. Mm. And it was the letting that other part of you take control, it was that voice could make these decisions that you
were that's right. Yeah. And the funny thing was voice was very bold, you know, doing things that I wouldn't dare do. You know, believe it or not, I'm quiet. Ask her. Yeah, my personality is not, I'm not out there where his voice was. And that was funny because it was kind of like the opposite that I was there, you know, at in the group.
Yeah, the problem was that voice would get you into trouble.
But that was the thing, I got in trouble with the voice.
And then
it kind of, and sometimes it was dangerous, you know, the things that was asked of me to do. So, you know, there's that fine line between fun and
self-harm.
This doesn't sound like something I should be doing.
And I wonder with the kind of putting you in captivity, do you think that was David Koresh was, he could see that something
was not right.
And he wanted to
absolutely, because he knew my personality, and that's why he said to everybody, you know, it's just the same, you know, person that we know.
Same quiet door.
Yeah. Mm. So he knew, and the guard on duty also said to me, you know, this is funny that you're this way, because every time certain people come into the group, they end up like you. You know, they just go crazy. You know, every time they're near David, there's something that happens to them. Yeah, so, you know, he was saying, you know, this is not the first time this has happened to people, to a person.
On David Koresh himself, I was reading in the book that I think one of you or maybe both of you were kind of not that impressed when you first
saw him.
Yeah.
And you as well, at the beginning.
At the beginning, I was kind of like, oh, this is a prophet.
I guess we all have some preconceived ideas of what a prophet should look like, but we were taking it from the Bible version.
I'm expecting long robe, hair, the beard. I mean, did he have the beard? No, he didn't have the beard then.
Some nerdy looking spectacles in.
Preconceived ideas. Yeah. It was nothing. I mean, how y'all doing? You know, twang. You know,
but no, it was definitely not my idea of what a prophet should look like. But then, hey, what is?
As soon as he started about the Bible, it was kind of, oh, okay, now I get it. I know. Okay, I know exactly why they're drawn to him. Mm. You know, it was just fascinating to listen to and to watch.
Especially if you've been brought up with knowing what is in the Bible. Mm. And, that's what probably enthralled, and that's called thraldom, enthralled everybody, was just him being able to. And in Isaiah 55, it says this, in Zechariah chapter 6, in Matthew 28.
And he appeared to know how to harmonize the different scriptures.
He knew how to connect them all, and he wouldn't be reading, he'd be quoting word verbatim. So that was what. And so I think that appealed to what we were looking for. We were looking to grow. Well, I was looking to grow in the study of God's word, of the study of the Bible. And here was someone that, wow, I knew it from back to cover to cover. And I said, I can do this. But, then it came down to the mundane things. I just wasn't sure how
you know, how to connect him, especially when I knew the qualities of the Lord Jesus Christ as being mild and meek and also loving and caring and empathy, you know, have empathy, sympathy, and all the love qualities. It just didn't seem to match, and that kind of got sort of covered up with what we were hearing and watching of him and what he could do. So thraldom through us. And
he was a real actor too, you know?
He was a drama king.
He was amazing to it. You know, he could do
switch from one emotion different to
roles
the next.
You know, he would play different roles. And it was just like watching an actor, you know, just everything, you know, because I'm very visual, and, you know, as he was out there acting the different parts of the Bible and how people reacted, you know, he would actually bring it all out, and we were just sitting there, you know, just amazed, you know. So, you know, he's this hippie-looking guy, and he's got all these different giftings, you know, talents, and he was using them, you know, to draw us in, and he did.
And there were also times where he would show his compassion. There were times when we would be, our shuttle bus was travelling from California to Palestine, Texas, and he'd see some homeless person. He said, just stop the bus, and he'd just go over and does anybody got any food for this young lady? You know, and that's the kind of thing that drew us, you know, we thought, wow, you know, love. But then he'll go to the extreme and he'd be beating up his son with a wooden spoon, you know, relentlessly. So, you know, we were just so mixed up. But we said, oh, there's a God. And then he would say, there's a God of love. And then there's a God of judgment, of, you know, there's an angry God because you can't do as you're told. We had handed all our sense of judgment and reason over. He just played games. He started playing games and acting on the stage. When somebody did something wrong, he'd be, God, do I have to put up with this? You know, how long? You know, that kind of thing. And then he'd woo you again. He'd woo people.
So it's up just and down. Your emotions are constantly up and down. You know, you'd be, oh, this is great. And then you'd just drop you right down, call you a nothing, and then he'd bring you back up again. And so it's constantly your emotions were up and down.
Information got to him, and you wonder, oh, how did he know? Oh, of course, somebody told him, you know. And those things, those personal things that belong to you, are no longer personal. When your boundaries, your own personal boundaries, are first moved and moved further and then broken down, you're a puppet. You've been won over, and you are capable of doing anything he tells you to do. If he needed somebody hurt, you would go and hurt that person if he told you. And it's not you. So that's how he would get his henchmen to, you know, paddle somebody if they stepped out of line. Yeah, they had one for the men, one for the women. Yeah, so I feel for those people. I know where they came from. It wasn't their fault. They were manipulated. And there's only one person accountable, is that predator. I know this doesn't sound a good thing to say, but I'm glad he died in that fire, but he was so cowardice that he took everybody in there with him.
This was a very tragic thing that happened. Yes, we both got wounded in some way as a result. However, I'd like to say that through the pain and through the hurt that we've gone through, we're in a position now to help others who are needing any sort of help in this area. We're in a position to be a resource, you know, and I've always wanted to be a resource. Because in New Zealand at that time, there was a, you know, cult watcher here, but they were just starting up, so they weren't equipped, you know, to help us. So we had to try and figure out our own way. And if we can be a resource that we've never had, you know, I think, you know, this is a good thing that's come out of all this. My hope is that people would read the book and pass it on to others. And
who knows, you know, who knows who's out there who may need this help. So we would like to also show people, hey, you know, there is hope. You can actually come out of a bad situation and survive.
And live
not,
a life.
Not just survive, but, you know, live your life again. But a bit wiser.
Lessons learned.
Lessons learned. Yeah, so we're glad the book, our story is finally out there, and that was the whole purpose of, you know, writing our story, is to help others,
and also it was therapeutic for both of us.
Oh, it was great
writing it. You know, that was something that I knew we needed to go through a lot of healing, but that kind of sped things up because we had to go into that memory, into those moments, into those struggles and pain and fear, and get it out and verbalize it through written script. So those processes weren't easy, and we're thankful that, and we encourage others who have been through similar situations to do the same, even though it's going to be difficult. We've found on this side of it now so much more freeing. We are able to talk about it without too much emotion. And now we've cried together. We've let out a lot of stuff. We still, you know, there's still little things, but it's a lighter journey now. It's a lighter journey out of it. Yeah. And we're thankful that we did it. And we're just so excited that we can give this resource to those that will be able to relate to it, because every group may be in a different context, but every group went through the same kinds of manipulation, exploitation, and fears. Yeah, I was also thankful that Grace had pulled me in, because I had kept a lot of stuff to myself and I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to just forget about the past and just bury it, cover it up. But there were things in my life that I was doing that I knew were connected to that weren't wholesome things. And so when she came back and talked about this book and did the series, it drew me in, and I knew, okay, having her here was what I really needed. And so I was ready. And when she drew me in, I felt, this is good. I felt good about starting a book. And I also got you into it as well.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of blame, self-blame, a lot of guilt there that I had to get rid of, and a lot of stuff that we had to sort of talk out and talk through. Just a lot of forgiveness that had to take place. So that's... it's not just a book, it's our therapy. It's the therapy that we needed to move forward and to be able to not have to repeat our story to everybody that asks us, so what happened? Okay, read the book. That was basically what was happening. Oh, so what happened? You know, we need to write a book. And so it's basically, so that was, here we go. Yeah, it may not be a big book, but it covers pretty much the... what we wanted people to know.
Up till now, we've just been doing cult awareness, and that's really for people like yourself who have not been, you know, in one of those abusive groups before. However, are wanting to learn and understand more the mindset. We actually have set up a group called GPS Recovery Group. So this group is for former members who have been out for at least 4 months and are wanting to kind of move ahead or understand how to move ahead.
So if people want to find out about that group?
They can email cultrecoveryinfo@gmail.com.
And there was a book that you, I think you both maybe mentioned, or particularly yourself, that seemed to... you had a lot of extracts that might have been really helpful.
Take Back Your Life.
Yeah, that was Madeline Tobias and Jana Lalich.
Yeah, we both used that. Just we one both, text, yeah. And it was the ideal reference book for us to be able to explain what had happened to us. And there's also the jargon that's in there, like triggers, loaded language, which I didn't know anything about till I started reading that, and that was just during the writing of the book. And how many years later, you know, I kind of have a label for what I was going through. So triggers, loaded language, cognitive dissonance, that kind of thing, you know. And I was hearing this at the training, and it was like, good, I understand. We had some new ones, like gaslighting too. Yeah, that was another one. Yeah. Had you heard about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just educating yourself. It's really important, and it just frees you knowing that, hey, I wasn't going crazy.
Yeah. And why this area of life, you know, so far as abusive groups go, is not something big in the media or pretty much anywhere. I don't know. Possibly it's that shame, you know, that's attached to it, that I could be sucked in so easily, which really you're not. Yeah, it's our hope that in starting these groups, people know, oh, okay, Cult Recovery Info, that's where I go, that's who I contact to find out how I can be helped. A resource for New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's needed here. We don't have one of these groups here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just going to Australia for this conference, it was really good to see, you know, psychologists, and they run these once a year, and they're recognising it there, whereas here it's very covert and sort of complacent about groups, and yet we know of quite a few that are coming through, have the potential. Yeah, so Lalich and Tobias, that they're two authors that both came out of different groups.
Oh, they do.
They're both former members of different groups, and they've written this book. And so they refer a lot to the gurus of cult research, which is Lifton and Margaret Singer.
I initially, when I was going to write my book on my own, I was going to call it The Message, because we all always referred it to. But as time went on, I kind of had this in my mind, you know, this is, I thought, oh, we'll just call it Hākano Daughter.
So I guess it matches with three sisters from New Zealand, trapped to Waco, only to return. So the three sisters were daughters of someone else, and he's calling us into his realm.
If you look at the pose, you know, we talk about arm in arm, walking out arm in arm, you know, during some of the...
when we went to the chapel.
Yeah.
When we were walking through the airport terminals.
Arm in arm.
It's just that bonding through and us walking away towards light.
A very special thanks to Grace and Poya for their generosity and openness in sharing their experiences and wisdom with me for this episode. You can find their book, Hākano O Daughter, on bookbaby.com and in many other places now too. The email address provided by Grace and Poya is for support in New Zealand. If you've been personally affected by involvement in a cult or would like to support those who have been, you can find support or donate to Cult Information and Family Support if you're in Australia via www.cifs.org.au, and you can find resources outside of Australia with the International Cultic Studies Association via www.icsahome.com. If you or someone you know is in crisis or needs support right now, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14 in Australia. Or find your local crisis centre via the International Association for Suicide Prevention website at www.iasp.info. Let's Talk About Sects is researched and presented by Sarah Steele. Sound design and music is by Joe Gould. Head to ltaspod.com for links on how to support the production of this independent podcast via Patreon, merchandise or donation. And drop us a review on your podcast platform of choice or our Facebook page if you feel like it. Do please mention the show to a friend if you feel they might appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Have a lovely festive season, and I hope you'll join me again next episode.
Canada may be known as the friendliest country in the world, but make no mistake, it has some of the most shocking criminal cases too. My name is Christy, and I host Canadian True Crime. I'm Australian, but I've been living in Canada for many years. Canadian True Crime takes a deep dive into some of Canada's most well-known cases, like the Ken and Barbie killers, Robert Picton the pig farmer, and many smaller cases you probably haven't heard of but are just as fascinating. If you're looking for the facts of the case told in a narrative storytelling format with ambient music, you can find me on your favourite podcast app or social media just by searching for Canadian True Crime.
A very memorable, shocking, and bizarre crime that happened.
Seems almost too bizarre to be true.
Charged in a bizarre,
accused of dressing up as a clown.
The bizarre twist in this story.
The break they needed in this bizarre case.
The damage that this man has caused so far.
We've never seen anything like this. Anything like this.
Welcome to Beyond Bizarre True Crime. These are the stories that'll make you wonder if they came from Hollywood or if Hollywood took it from them.
Available on your favorite podcast app or online at Beyond Bizarre True Crime.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.